Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
For example, look at cotton futures. We know the situation in terms of cotton on the actual supply side of the equation, but December cotton had another bad day today, and it's been falling down pretty significantly for weeks now.
Bob Maurer, Manduka Trading, Chicago.
And you would think, just looking at the balance sheet for cotton, that it would be somewhere easily north of a buck, and then today we get down to 96 cents. So the things that are working its way into the cotton market are these macro events, the interest rate hawkishness of the Fed, the potential for more COVID lockdowns in China, the sharp move to the upside in the dollar. So it's really interesting to be trading these days because there's so many other things besides just the balance sheet, meaning the supply and demand side of the equation, that are really going to these markets and are going into it a lot quicker.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This is the work this committee should be doing as we prepare for the next Farm Bill.
Ranking member of the House Ag Committee from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson, on Tuesday at a Farm Bill hearing on conservation.
I am excited to hear from stakeholders about what is working and what isn't, and to hear more about what direction the title should take. Now, I've been a longtime supporter of our Farm Bill conservation programs. I was honored to serve as chairman of this subcommittee during the 2014 Farm Bill process. And we can all be proud of the bipartisan work we did in this title in both 2014 and 2018. But I have to tell you, folks, the way the majority in this administration has gone on an unprecedented spending spree with little to no input from Republicans and stakeholders have led to a situation where I think could endanger the bipartisan support of this title. And just the last month, Democrats have spent nearly $20 billion on conservation programs, and then the Biden administration has doubled down and spent $3.5 billion from the CCC on projects to make our food system align with corporate climate agendas. These actions are not good for the long-term viability of these programs. I hope in the next Congress, we can truly evaluate the funding needs for these programs, paired with an evaluation of the ability to effectively and judiciously deliver these funds to farmers. After making this evaluation, we can talk about what the real needs are for the title. Now, I don't feel bound by the amount of funding or to the specific program allocation passed in the partisan IRA bill. I especially am worried about the earmarking of all the new money just for climate rather than letting the locally led process work. Let me talk about some of my goals for the title. First, the producer should be at the center of any discussion. We want the conservation title to work for the producer and help not only provide environmental outcomes, but also good economic sense. We should also ensure that these programs are easy for producers to understand and access. We should look at ways to streamline and simplify our conservation programs. We should improve upon those aspects in CSP and RCPP, but the Conservation Reserve Program should be a part of that discussion. Second, I will not prioritize climate over every other natural resource concern, period. Third, I would like to see innovative solutions, whether that is emphasizing technology such as precision agriculture, like we have done in the Precise Act, or Mr. Davis's No Admits Act, or my own Sustains Act. We, as a party, will be the party of solutions. Fourth, we should emphasize working lands. Republicans have emphasized working land programs for the last two decades, even before it became popular in the conservation community. EQIP has been the workhorse and most popular of all programs, and we should be judicious in any changes we make to EQIP. Fifth, we should look at ways to improve our conservation delivery system. The Technical Service Provider Program is broken, and we should look at ways to improve that program to ensure that we have enough technical capacity on the ground, or, quite frankly, in the fields. Sixth, we should ensure private working forest lands are a part of our conservation title, and I will look for innovative ways to include working forests into these programs. In closing, I look forward to hearing from our witnesses. We have a great panel of witnesses today, and I look forward to continued oversight of these programs to evaluate how these programs can continue to provide the conservation benefits it has for decades. And I hope we can do that in a bipartisan way. I believe we can, and look forward to that instead of what's happened over the last 2 years.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
For many equipment dealers, parts revenue produces the majority of income for the business, though parts margins are far from inordinate.
Ken Taylor, President, Ohio Machinery Company, testifying on the right to repair in Congress.
If parts are required to be provided at cost, many dealers would be put out of business. Anyone can walk into an AED member facility or go online and buy OEM parts for their equipment. There's no restriction on who can purchase parts, whether it's an equipment owner, a third-party service provider, an equipment operator, or a member of the general public. However, there will be no incentive for an equipment dealer to carry parts inventory if the manufacturer or the dealer is forced to sell parts without the ability to make a profit. For the equipment industry, right-to-repair proposals are a solution in search of a problem. AED members provide customers and third-party repair providers with parts, tools, and other resources to complete the overwhelming majority of equipment repairs. Enacting these proposals will stifle entrepreneurship, and the result will be an unprecedented intrusion by government into the free enterprise system. I reflect on my grandfather and the reasons he got into the equipment distribution industry. He was looking for a better life for his family, the opportunity to create well-paying jobs and careers for his employees, and the privilege of giving back to the community, including in underserved areas like Appalachia. Most equipment dealers have similar stories because the United States allows entrepreneurs to pursue their dreams. Unfortunately, I worry that should these right-to-repair policies become law, the viability of the equipment distribution industry will be severely hampered, resulting in lost economic activity, job creation, technological advancements, and a less competitive America.
Representative Claudia Tenney from New York.
Just going to bring a couple of angles. Whenever government gets in the middle of it, it tends to overplay. I know all the witnesses talked about competition, and I heard an all or nothing approach. So I'm from New York State, and even as a lawyer, most of the bills that I looked at of any significance coming through our codes committee, which was our committee of jurisdiction, there was an angle for the trial lawyers to find liability on someone, particularly small business owners, without taking that into regard. So that's my concern, the liability issue. I'm concerned about intellectual property. Ma'am, you mentioned competition. You also mentioned competition. We mentioned competition. It seems to me that there could be a reasonable middle ground here on some of these issues, because I'll give you a perfect example. When I was young in our printing business, I learned how to operate a press in the 70s, beginning of the 80s, and it was hard work. I mean, there were no computers and no chips. You had to know how to gauge the water, the ink, and how to deal with the press. Now we actually operate a press that are very expensive, and you can operate them in a suit and never get any ink on you and be very clean, and the technology is very different. And also, as the former lawyer for our company, I've gone in and seen these, very expensive presses with duct tape on them. And that's because, a lot of our employees are former farmers, especially dairy farmers. They're like MacGyver. They can fix anything and they can make anything run, even if it has a chip in it. So, but I do think there's a middle ground. But I wanted to ask you, and just to respond maybe to some of the, comments made by Love the Vintage Farmer and the idea of that. We still have people in our communities, very rural upstate New York, who use vintage equipment. We also have a lot of Amish farmers who are still using horses.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
My name is Steve Nygren, founder and CEO of Serenbe, located in Chattahoochee Hills, Georgia's 13th Congressional District.
He was testifying recently before the House Ag Committee on regenerative ag.
I want to talk about soil health and how it leads to economic vitality. My written testimony will expand on these points. It starts with the local farm and farmers. The recognition that we need healthy soil should compel us to recognize our American agrarian economy and what drives it, starting with how we inhabit the landscape. We must produce food locally, implement policies and programs that support this local production, and prioritize regenerative organic farming. You are aware of the shrinking number of U.S. farmers and the conversion to industrial agriculture. replacing the local family farm. What we do not talk about is the effect on the local agrarian economy. Industrial ag dollars do not support the local bank, the local hardware store, or the Main Street merchants in the same way that local farmers do. Rural America has been stripped of its identity and economic stability. We're now feeling some of the negative results of this drastic shift and consolidation. The good news is there has been a renewed interest in local farms, markets, and food that continues to accelerate. The pandemic has also placed a spotlight on food production, the increased health issues our country faces, and how people are dramatically reassessing where they live and what they eat. In 1950, Georgia produced 80% of the food consumed in the state. Today, it is a fraction of that amount. We are consuming products imported from around the world and eating food grown on U.S. soil with detrimental chemicals based on relationships with foreign governments. This increased dependence on a global supply chain for our food could make the difficulties of the pandemic seem mild should there be a disruption in our global industrial food system. Think of soil health as a platform to bring our small towns back to life. When farming and soil is rescued, then many other businesses and value-added productions will follow. Soil health is imperative to American health. Through the Farm Bill and the direct actions of this committee, you can affect real change for our farmers, our food systems, our economy, and our communities. I urge you to fund organizations that will directly impact small and historically marginalized farmers working to produce regenerative organic foods.
But the status quo just won't get it done, says Jeff Moyer, CEO of the Rodell Institute.
Yes, of course, it's critical that we move rapidly to make adjustments to allow farmers to express their desire to improve the health of their soil. Regenerative agriculture, regenerative organic agriculture is all part of a journey, and we're not suggesting that conventional agriculture or conventional farming has not made great advances since the 1950s, but we also have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. The concept that we simply want to sustain a current system or current set of practices to maintain what we have is not adequate. We really need to move forward rapidly with the concept of regenerating the health of our soil to build up earthworm populations, as Mr. Scott already told us about between his farm and his neighbors. We can do that. Again, we have the tools, we have the time, we have the ability, we need support from members of this committee and from policymakers in order to just tweak some of the programs that we have to allow farmers to make the decisions on their landscapes to improve the health of their soil.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Feeder cattle in Dodge City took quite a bit of a hit from the prior week. We were down about $10 to $15 across a couple of the weight groups.
The director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center, Caitlin McCulloch.
Mostly on the lighter weight cattle side, if you look at 400 to, let's say, about 650 or 700 pounds, all of those fell probably $4 to $15 a hundredweight over the prior week. Now, if you look at some of the heavier weight cattle, this is all on the cash market out of Dodge City. Those two slipped a little bit, but it was a little more mixed. Heavier weight cattle seemed to maintain what week ago was, roughly in the 160s for 800 pound plus, but 7 and 8 also took a little bit of a hit from the prior week. Now that's a little bit different than what's happened in the futures market for feeder cattle. If we look at some of these fall contracts, specifically the October one, last week it fell pretty substantially. It was positive when it ended the week, but we definitely were week over week a little bit lower. That contract's at 181 at the close of Friday. On the fed cattle side, we're holding 142 on Friday for live steers FOB, 142.89, so still a very strong price out there for fed cattle. The futures market was a little choppy last week and closed the week slightly, ever so slightly, above last week on the close, but it was a little bit of a mixed bag throughout the week. Box beef, there's been a little bit of concern over the last, let's say, 10 days or so. We've seen that choice value fall. We're now firmly in the 250s range, and you know, we were about 252 to close the week last week, so the lowest price we've seen in quite some time. Just keep in mind the box beef on average this year has been above a year ago and above the 5-year, well above historical norms, but we also haven't seen nearly as much seasonality as normally we would expect box beef to fall during this time, at least to some degree, as we change over from summer grilling meats back into more of our winter warmers, as some might like to call them, you know, the pot roasts and crock pot type items.
And she breaks down the most recent export numbers.
So this has been something that we don't emphasize all the time because it is preliminary data. What it's telling us is what sales have happened. And so that doesn't necessarily translate to meat export. Those things can get canceled, moved around, or shipped at a different time than maybe you're expecting. But to go a whole month without the information, you know, it rattled the markets a little bit, especially on the pork side when it came back out. But in general, over those 4 weeks compared to a year ago, and I'm talking about mid-August, so 8/18 through 9/8 is the data we're referencing, was down about 8%. So maybe not a positive necessarily number, but it helps us know where we're at. And on the pork side, I think that was down about 10%. When we look at different countries, and that can be some of the more interesting thing, especially since so much of beef export growth has come from China this year, it's kind of interesting to look at those numbers. So China was actually down in that 4-week period compared to a year ago, about 3%. A couple other countries, you know, in that 5 to 10% loss range. But a couple interesting countries that were up. Canada was up 3% during that time period. Mexico also had a very strong month, or 4-week period, I should say. They're up 20% in terms of volume. And so these numbers can shift around. We won't get actually, you know, that August data until the first week of October, and we won't get September until the month after that. So something we kind of keep an eye on to at least give us a barometer of what's happening, but definitely helpful for the industry to know, and the futures market definitely reacted to it this week with that information coming back online.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Intellectual property is not involved in repair. Many people assume that it is, but it is not.
Recent discussion over the right to repair from the House Small Business Committee.
The copyright law, the DMCA of 1998, has specific provisions in it to allow people to back up and restore all of their licensed software at no copyright peril. Patents are already public. So if Chinese people are ripping off patents, nothing about right to repair is going to add to that capability. It's all, that's already been done. That horse is out of the barn, so to speak. There's really no actual peril. The copyright law and the, I believe it was Senators Leahy and Grassley requested a study of the Copyright Office back in 2016 and 17 about the specific rights under copyright law and under the 1201 exemption process, and they found that there's nothing wrong with copyright law.
We continue to hear that manufacturers are still leaning on this as a barrier. Are you saying that that's not correct? Or are they just doing it erroneously?
They're pretty disingenuous.
You know, I would say today in the equipment business, the innovation that's occurring is extraordinary. Hard parts at one time were a part of a product's competitive advantage, and today as much as hard parts as the software and the code that provides more power, more efficiency, longevity, all the features that one wants in a piece of equipment, a tool on a job, software supports much of that today, which is just an entirely different picture. It's new ground for all of us to cope with, I think.
So I'm sorry to interrupt you real quickly before my time elapses. So A, how can we help with that? Because if in fact there's a remedy in place yet, manufacturers are still using this, then obviously tell us how we can, from this committee standpoint, help address that so that's no longer a barrier. And then lastly, and you guys can answer this, whoever wants to, but lastly, I represent several rural areas in Louisiana, and obviously people have issues with repair in the city. They have their access to more repair shops. How do you deal with those rural areas who don't have a plethora of resources as it relates to close proximity to have their trucks repaired or the vehicles repaired?
I don't know if you're asking Ken or myself, but the solution for repair in general is having more. The more businesses that can form that can provide repair services locally, the more options there will be for our communities. So it would be very helpful, I think, for your constituents to be able to use a local shop as opposed to having drive to, let's say, New Orleans. So what you could do would be to help support some of the bills that are already in Congress that will make things easier.
You know, I think one of the challenges is the amount of training that's required for an individual that might be local in a community far away from a dealer. The training and knowledge that's required to effectively make a repair are extensive. And so I guess perhaps if the repair shop were willing to pay, you know, a fee for the training to help them perhaps do more, maybe not everything they want to do, but more, that could be arranged. But is that a cost that business is willing to bear?
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
No, it's going to take several more of those. And I think, you know, the aspect of having a triple dip La Nina is probably on a lot of people's mind. I know it's on mine.
So that's Kevin Brinkley. He's president and CEO of Lubbock-based Plains Cotton Cooperative Association.
If the La Nina kind of hangs on through the wintertime and even into early spring, it's going to just amplify the pressure on us next year to get some really good replenishing rains in late spring so we can plant another crop. So that's another watch point for us as we navigate our way out of this particular crop and hope for something that's a little bit better going on. I think those rains, predominantly, the benefit from those was for farmers that were irrigating, they got to shut those wells off and save a lot of money on electricity because they had already spent quite a bit. And that's, you know, one of the biggest issues this year is that if you have a crop, you certainly got a lot in it at this point. So, you never turn down a rain, but we certainly going to need a whole lot more to recover from what we've been through.
And he agrees markets right now being pulled in both directions, but who are the players in the game?
The entities and farmers that are involved in futures markets are actually quite a small portion of that. And you have a large amount of invested money, money managers that are speculating in the cotton market. And, all through the spring, they sort of, read a pretty good demand picture out there. And certainly they can look at weather reports like anybody else. And so they begin to buy cotton. And then the Federal Reserve comes along. And I don't think it's a mystery to most people that they probably put too much money into the economy back during the pandemic, trying to deal with all of that, and probably were late to take that sugar away from us. And so now they're fighting the inflation of having too many dollars chasing too few goods, and they're going to probably continue to raise rates. I think it's near guaranteed that we'll get 75 points of interest rate hike this go around, and probably maybe a couple more just like it to follow on, and that is putting a crimp in demand. And so it's not just the Federal Reserve either. This is European central banks, any central bank in Asia is looking at this. What do you have to do to put enough pressure on the economy to cool off inflation? And that inflation is, it's a pretty staggering thing to a household that is starting to see, we're a year plus into what we would call hot inflation prints. And, wages have probably gone up. They haven't kept up with the increase in prices. So got a little break with a drop in energy prices recently. But when you look at core inflation, things that don't tend to be very volatile, those numbers keep climbing. And I think that's what you've seen in terms of pressure on commodity markets. You've certainly seen in the stock market. All of those things are really a headwind against demand.
And current conditions continue to be a challenge.
Just a few days ago, that showed the Texas crop at 3.2. I think it's probably a little bit optimistic, and probably, you know, the 250,000 bales they've got for Oklahoma is too optimistic as well. So I hate to report such bad news, but that's kind of the cards that we've been dealt this year, and we'll just have to make the best of it and hope for some more favorable weather next season.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
National Farm Safety and Health Week from September 18th through 24th focuses on the theme of protecting agriculture's future.
The folks that are working the farm is agriculture's future.
Dan Neenan of the National Education Center for Agricultural Safety says this year's awareness and education campaign involves daily topics of focus, featuring webinars covering various aspects of farm safety and health, as well as programs and social media promotion with sponsors, local fire departments during Grain Bin Safety Week, and local community college agricultural students.
It's that one time of the year, either during harvest or right before harvest, that we can focus on agricultural safety as a whole and bring that awareness of how dangerous agriculture can be.
More details about National Farm Safety and Health Week are available online at www.necasag.org/National Farm Safety and Health Week, all one word, /. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.